Welcome to CITR 101 FM's Black History Month series, broadcasting from UBC Vancouver on unceded Coast Salish Musqueam land. Every week in February, from 1 p.m. to 2 p.m. on Wednesday, tune into a new selection of curated content commemorating Black History Month. CITR hopes to do its part to bring more attention to the rich and varied history of Black peoples in the Coast Salish territories and beyond. For today's episode, we feature two segments from CITR programmers and one documentary, which will be airing on CITR for the first time. First, we'll be listening to a segment from CITR's Arts Report. Christine Kim and Jake Clark interview the artistic director of Early Music Vancouver about Le Mozart Noir, a concert with material from Chevalier St. George's. One of the earliest musicians of the European classical tradition with African ancestry, the son of a slave who overcame adversities of class, race, and prejudice to become a major star all over Europe. This concert took place on the evening of February 4th, so unfortunately you cannot go see it. However, documentaries and more information about St. George's are available online. Afterwards, you'll hear the CITR debut of Vancouver's Viaducts and Lesson of Hogan's Alley, produced by Rachel Sanders, with contributing production from Alexander Kim and Stefan LeBay. And finally, the hour will conclude with a segment from Issa Arie's Off the Beat and Path. You can find all of our 2017 Black History Month special programming online at CITR.ca. Please stay tuned now for an interview from CITR's Arts Report.
Mm-hmm. And I think the questions that we had were going to be answered, because with us on the line now is Matthew White.
Hi there.
Howdy.
Perfect. Great to have you with us, joining us live on the show today. How are you doing?
I'm doing wonderful. Thank you.
So my name is Christine, and my co-host,
Jake Clark,
already has questions about Le Mozart Noir, which is going to be happening at the Vancouver Playhouse this upcoming Saturday, February the 4th at 8 p.m.
So my first question right off the bat is this based off the film Amadeus, or does this have more to do just with a musical biography of Shakespeare himself? A musical biography of Shakespeare. That's a separate one altogether.
Indeed. Okay, so in short, this is a concert, first and foremost, but we're preceding it with a documentary film screening at 6:30 about the life of one of the four composers on the program. And the documentary is on the life of the Chevalier de Saint-Georges, who was he's not a very well-known figure in history, and that's not fair. And that's really one of the reasons why we're putting on the concert. He was a black violinist who was the son of a slave owner in Guadeloupe, and of a slave who was working on the plantation. He was brought back to Paris, where his father educated him in the violin and also in fencing. And not only did he become one of the greatest violinists of 18th century France, but he also became the greatest fencer in France at the same time. So you can imagine this is a really extremely accomplished person. So this concert is just an effort to redress him being submerged beneath the waves of history, as it were. And it's a great opportunity to hear some music that some people will never have heard, and to hear it in the context of some of the other great composers of exactly the same period in late 18th century Europe. So Mozart, Haydn, and also there's Leclerc. There's a big violin concerto by Le Mozart Noir's teacher.
And when you say that it was unfair that Chevalier de Saint-Georges is not as well known as, you know, his counterparts of the same period, do you say that because of the fact of his skin color, that because he was black, he didn't get as much attention, regardless, you know, of how great his abilities were?
Yeah, I mean, I think we can't underestimate the extent to which 18th century French was a different civilization, and it was clearly a very not just racist civilization, but a classist civilization. It was this is pre French Revolution France, and this was the music of the aristocracy, and a black musician coming to play this music, and not just play it well, but to be the best at it, is something that would have challenged all of their accepted realities, right? So and in fact, you know, he was so good that the people who could recognize how good he was suggested that he should take one of the most important musical positions in France at the time, which was head of the Paris Opera. But he sadly didn't get the job because three of the head divas in the company at the time sent a letter to the king saying, "We will never submit to the will of a mulatto." Yeah, but that's just the way it was, and it's obviously sad, but it's not surprising somehow, you know.
No, it's not.
But the music is wonderful, and so in the thing is that basically we just decided that it would be a fun concert to put on, not just because the story is an interesting one. I mean, this is an extraordinary musical talent from the 18th century who's a black person, which is, you know, something that everybody should know about because it's extraordinary. Mm-hmm. But two, because the music it doesn't need any narrative to be interesting. You see what I'm saying? It doesn't. We don't really need to put a concert of symphonies by St. George on just because it makes a good story and because he was a black man. The fact is, it's fabulously great music, and he changed the possibilities for playing the violin in the 18th century. He pushed the technical boundaries of the instrument further than anybody else had at that point.
What were some of those innovations?
Well, he just, for instance, he played way, way much higher on the fingerboard than most violinists had gone before. Hmm. And some of the stuff that he asks the left hand to do are just, it's just technically a lot more challenging than music you'd seen before that. And that's what all my violinist friends tell me anyway. They all say, yeah, no, he was pushing the envelope in terms of what was technically possible at the time.
And you yourself, how did you find out about Chevalier's music?
Well, strangely, I mean, I used to be a singer, and I sang with orchestras and choirs pretty much all over the world. And one of the orchestras that I did a lot of work with was a Canadian orchestra called Tafel Music Baroque Orchestra, who are based out of Toronto. And I was there singing and noticed one day that they had a DVD for sale of a documentary that they had recently done. And it was a documentary on the life of the Chevalier Saint-Georges, where they tell a bit of his story and play a bunch of his music and do interviews with contemporary black classical music artists to sort of, you know, give their perspective. And I just thought it was a charming story, and I also thought that the music was, you know, ridiculously beautiful for somebody, you know, that I'd never heard of. You just thought, like, what? Why haven't I heard of that? Because that's really superbly beautiful music, and that's when I first heard about him. And I know that our music director Alexander Weimann has always loved his work, has always loved his compositions, and Monica Huggett, who's the guest soloist for this concert, is one of the world's great Baroque violinists, and she says exactly the same thing. She says this is music of the highest standard, and it's really fun and challenging to play.
So in terms of technical mastery, where would you put him among the comparators that you've set him, like Haydn and Mozart?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a hard thing for me to say exactly, because, you know, Haydn and Mozart are just absolutely undisputed masters. But what I would say is that, you know, when you hear a symphony by Saint-Georges next to them, it doesn't pale in comparison. It's absolutely comparable, and interesting and slightly different and idiomatic of the period while still pushing boundaries. So it's wonderful context for the late 18th century. It's fun to hear it, and it's technically sound, more than sound, inspiring. Yeah.
And this performance is in celebration of Black History Month, and I was wondering if you had any comments about the importance of this month in general, and how you think that Early Music Vancouver will be supporting the different narratives of this month through this performance.
Well, I mean, I just, you know, I think it's a pretty straightforward answer that the arts belong to everybody, you know, and I think it's important to remind people that, you know, skin color is one thing, it's only a part of who we are, and we should all be aware that there's a lot of culture out there that we're not aware of and that's worth hearing. And I think in this case, bringing the work of a genius who was a black man in the 18th century is only good. It's just another demonstration of the fact that that the arts belong to all of us.
That's an admirable sentiment, certainly is. And now you mentioned that he's a genius who's also a black man in the 18th century, and that's probably, like, when you think of This Is Beautiful Music, why did I not hear him? Probably because he was a black man in the 1800s. Like, it was certainly not a good time in that regard. Does the show throw any focus on that at all, on the situation that he might have faced outside of his music?
Well, the documentary that we're pre-screening screening before the show tells that story in very vivid detail, in fact, you know. And it's a great story. His father obviously had enormous affection for his son. Slavery was where they were living in Guadeloupe, and he knew that living in Guadeloupe, his son would be stuck a slave, you know. And in 18th century France, slavery had just been abolished, so he knew that by bringing his son back, he at least would not be bringing his son back. He would be able to raise his son in a free environment. But there's a lot of emotional aspects to the story, and one of them is the fact that as a black man, he was never going to be able to marry into the aristocracy, even though he was he was living in that world, right? He was never going to be able to marry a white woman, even though those were all the women that he was coming in contact with. So, there are stories of him, apparently having been a really renowned lover, and that the women loved him.
I was going to say, he sounds like he does sound like a sort of a swashbuckler hero, like master violinist, champion fencer, like if you excellent lover kind of follows there. Like he sounds like a really dashing and interesting character.
Yeah, I mean, he obviously must have been attractive to women, in that he was enormously talented, you know. So, but there always must have been that realization that. That he was never going to be allowed to live in aristocratic circles comfortably. He was never going to be able to have a normal relationship, long-term relationship. That was not going to be a reality for him. And that must have been really difficult.
Right. And I do think it is really cool that it's not just the music that is the highlight of the evening, but also that documentary that you mentioned, explaining a little bit more about Chevalier's life beyond the music. Do you mind giving us the details of ticketing for Les Mozart Noir? Any of our students here on campus that is interested in coming to see the show, given what you've said, how can people find out more?
Well, first of all, I mean, they can just go to www.earlymusic.bc.ca. If they want to, they can also just show up the night of the concert. It looks like the ticket sales are going very well, but there will be a few extras. So we have student rush tickets, which are just $10. You can just go to the door, and for $10, you can get a really good seat.
Mm-hmm.
And $10, if I can just remind the students out there, that's a lot less than you pay to go to the movies nowadays. And instead, you're going to be
Definitely.
Able to get to see a movie. And a world-class performance with a period instrument orchestra for $10, which is a pretty good deal.
And when is this event? Where and when?
The concert is this Saturday night, February 4th. The screening starts at 6:30, and the performance starts at 8 o'clock. So there's enough time for a coffee or a drink in between.
And we're actually... go ahead.
And it's happening at the Vancouver Playhouse, which is right downtown.
Oh, good venue.
And we're actually going to be doing a ticket giveaway for this show. So before we let you go, Matthew, can you give just any final words about this performance, about why students in particular should come see the performance? Maybe a little bit of a promotion of why this is something, a good way to spend a student's Saturday evening.
Well, I mean, if you're interested in learning something new, there's a lot of new things to be learned and new sounds to be heard. So I think for anybody who's curious about music that they don't know, played by really some of the greatest instrumentalists that we have on the West Coast playing period instruments, they can't go wrong. It's a great story about a really important musical figure that they may not have heard of, and then they get a chance to hear some of his music played right in front of their faces, and all for less than the price of a movie. So, I'd say it's your moral obligation. Go and learn something new.
And
exciting.
It's always a pleasure to have you on the show, Matthew, especially as the artistic director of Early Music Vancouver, the kind of performances that you guys do. It's always a pleasure to be able to talk about it.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, and I hope some of the students on campus decide to come out and take advantage of a really good deal and hear some beautiful music.
Great. Well, thank you again, and we look forward to the performance that evening.
Cheers.
Okay. Cheers. Thank you very much.
That was Matthew White, the Artistic Director of Early Music Vancouver.
To hear more from the Arts Report, to CITR between 5 p.m. and 6 p.m. on Wednesdays, that is, today, or find their podcast online at citr.ca/radio/arts-report. That is, citr.ca/radio/arts-report. Coming up now, we are proud to debut Rachel Sanders' Vancouver Viaducts and the Lesson of Hogan's Alley. For those who do not know, Hogan's Alley is historically Vancouver's only black community. The neighborhood was put on the chopping block along with all of Chinatown and much of Strathcona in order to make way for a freeway development during the 70s. The freeway project was eventually halted by community protest and action, but not before Hogan's Alley was demolished. Today in Vancouver, if you look for Hogan's Alley, you will find the Georgia Viaduct, and that is where the story begins. Production was done by Rachel Sanders, with contributing production from Alexander Kim and Stefan LeBay. Please enjoy.
Lincoln Alexander was a black Canadian who achieved much in politics. The child of Jamaican immigrants, he served in the Royal Canadian Air Force during World War II. He graduated from the Osgoode Hall Law School in 1953 and practiced at a number of firms for more than a decade. In 1968, he ran in Canada's federal election in the Hamilton West Electoral District. He won and became Canada's first black member of parliament. He served four consecutive terms before stepping down in 1980. In 1985, he was appointed Lieutenant Governor of Ontario, becoming the first black Canadian to hold a viceregal position. Alexander passed away on October 19, 2012. In December 2013, Lincoln Alexander Day was made a law in Ontario and is held on January 21st. His wife, Marnie Beale Alexander, is currently working to make it a national holiday for Canada. This has been a Black History Month PSA brought to you by CITR.
We all know that the word jazz means many different things to many different people, so check out the real deal on The Jazz Show at CITR 101.9 FM or CITR.ca for live streaming. Yours truly, Gavin Walker, is your host, and I guarantee the straight goods of 3 hours of jazz at its finest. So come on by and give your ears a musical workout, 9 p.m. Mondays. Don't miss it.
From the corner of Main to the alley on Union, that's where you would find the spot. Mm-hmm. Vi's Chicken and Steaks was pretty, pretty hot, let me tell you.
This is Bertha Clark, also known as Adeline the Soul Poet. She grew up in Vancouver. Her grandmother, Viva Moore, owned a restaurant on Main Street.
So my grandmother came over to Vancouver and opened a restaurant called Vi's Chicken and Steaks in Hogan's Alley in the 40s.
The neighborhood known as Hogan's Alley sat between Union and Pryor Street from Main Street to Jackson Avenue. It was the only predominantly black neighborhood Vancouver has ever known. There was a lively scene there throughout the 1940s and 1950s.
A lot of the entertainers would come up, Sammy Davis Jr., Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald. It was quite a few of them that would come up and do their thing in the clubs in the city. And then after their set, say 1-2 o'clock in the morning, well, they come to the restaurant just to have a good meal, okay? You can get a T-bone, a sirloin, or a filet mignon for $5.60. The biscuits were the big thing. They just sold right off. They were gone, you know, that was it, you know. So
there's nothing left of that lively neighborhood today. Hogan's Alley is gone too.
So we're actually standing at the lane just east of Main Street on Union Street, next to the Georgia Viaducts and on a recently redeveloped block of Strathcona.
This is Vancouver civic historian John Atkin.
So this was the black community, but it was again like a Vancouver neighborhood. It was always a little bit mixed and stuff like that. You had the church at one end, and you had sort of the entertainment and the restaurants down at this end. But if we were to walk and try to pinpoint landmarks, we don't really have physical landmarks left that we can actually point to. So that's the interesting thing about Hogan's Alley, is that it exists, but it doesn't exist. So,
in the 1930s and 1940s, cities all over North America began redeveloping degraded neighborhoods. In the 1950s, Vancouver got into the game.
Urban renewal was Canadian euphemism for ghetto busting, slum clearance, all those sorts of things. We were just more polite about the expropriation.
Urban renewal was often linked to the building of urban freeways. The first part of Vancouver's freeway plan was a pair of brand new viaducts that would swoop from Strathcona all the way into the downtown core.
The viaducts, Georgia Viaducts, just behind us, erased the alley, the buildings, and now we have traffic and concrete.
But the targeting of Hogan's Alley by the city of Vancouver began long before the Georgia Viaduct went up in 1973.
When I arrived, it was quite a different neighborhood.
Randy Clark is Bertha Clark's brother. He and Bertha and the rest of their family came to Vancouver in 1965. They moved into the neighborhood where their grandmother was running her restaurant. Clark says the city had deliberately neglected the neighborhood since the 1940s.
They had made the decision that it wasn't necessary to continue with the upkeep of the neighborhood. The roads, they were awful. Any home that had been abandoned, they would leave it to rot. And eventually, the grass grew as high as the front door of this old home or the porch of this old home. And that decayed. So on the block where we lived, none of the homes were being cleaned up or fixed.
Blight is death to a city. And these dwellings, built with such hope and care at the turn of the century, are dying board by board. Most of Vancouver...
In 1957, Vancouver City Council designated the area between Union and Prior Street, from Main Street to Jackson Avenue, as blighted. In other words, a slum.
It was decided to launch a 20-year redevelopment program.
The city's neglect had left the neighborhood to fall into a state of disrepair, and that, in turn, gave the city the excuse it needed to push residents out.
Civic governments. But with confidence, Vancouver has accepted the challenge, knowing that to build a better city requires only the industry and ingenuity of man.
Randy Clark says there was a reason why Hogan's Alley was targeted by the city.
They profiled a particular group in order to get them out of that area. Systemic racism is a term that I've heard. What they did not take into consideration was there was a community of fine people, great people, community people who lived there.
By the time the city broke ground on the viaducts, the black community was mostly already gone, driven out by the neglect of the neighborhood and dispersed across the city and to different parts of the province. After the viaducts went up, the community that remained in Strathcona protested against the freeway that was slated to run through their neighborhood.
They had members from City Hall, the mayor, and all the VIPs drive across the viaduct first time. Well, at the other end, they pelted those vehicles with eggs. They had signs and everything. They banged on the cars. They said, this is enough. And that's when the talk of freeway stopped.
That was the end of the freeway plans, but it was too late for the residents of Hogan's Alley. 40 years later, the viaducts are the subject of controversy yet again.
Hello.
Hi, Ms. Allen.
Hi there. Today, Your Worship, you and Council are here to decide on action. Action that will impact many in Vancouver and will impact the region.
But in the fall of 2015, Vancouver City Council held meetings to discuss the future of the viaducts. The structures are unsound now, and they need to be either renovated or removed. Business representatives and community members presented their concerns at City Council. Members of the Black community came out as well.
You have an obligation to address past unjust actions taken by former council and staff by pursuing policies and action that will seek to bring restoration and regeneration in this place.
Vancouver author Wade Compton was there too. He has written extensively about Hogan's Alley in his poetry and essays.
To me, it doesn't matter so much stay or go with the viaducts. It matters that there's some marker there that stays, that reminds people of the history that created the viaducts in the first place, you know? And so for us, I feel like this is an opportunity for there to be the creation of some kind of cultural, Black cultural center at that site. That would be great. But I am also worried about what that, you know, Black cultural center might be beside.
Compton says that as the land under and around the viaducts is redeveloped, there's a real possibility that history will repeat itself.
Obviously, the viaducts were what was built to displace the Black community. So I'm not fond of the viaducts, really, right? But on the other hand, they're there now. And so whether or not they stay or go is something that I think the people who live there should decide. Gentrification is the new urban renewal, really. I mean, and the communities that are displaced are poor communities. I mean, and that to me is the lesson of Hogan's Alley, is who will understand the place best other than the people whose families have been there a long time? Who's going to love a place that is a slum better than people who have stuck it out in that slum? That's what I wish had happened. And that's what needs to happen now, too, with places like the Downtown East Side. The people who live there need to have some mechanism whereby they can plan their own neighborhood.
As for Hogan's Alley, its former residents still wonder what might have been if the community had been allowed to grow and flourish.
I would have known more members of Vancouver's Black community better. I would have known the generation or generations that followed. I would have known more about the good things that the 2,000 members of the community did. I would have had more people to reference as heroes who were Black. So I missed out on things like that.
It's history, man. It's the history that we deserve to be recognized for. You know, it's you have to realize that my family in particular, they came to Canada in the 1850s, you know. So it don't be sweeping my people under the rugs, you know. It's the history of BC, Vancouver, BC. So it is the history of our people. So that's yeah. And the laughter would be jumping all night long up out of that place. First class dining advised. Chicken and steaks. Ooh.
That was Vancouver Viaducts and the Lesson of Hogan's Alley by Rachel Sanders, with contributing production from Alexander Kim and Stefan LeBay. For the final segment on today's episode of CITR Black History Month, we present a segment from CITR's Off the Beat and Path by Issa Arie. It's got some crucial words in the wake of recent events in the United States and some information about the legendary abolitionist Frederick Douglass. If you enjoy hearing from Issa, you can also find out more about Off the Beat and Path online at citr.ca/radio/off-the-beat-and-path. You can also listen live to Issa every Thursday, 7 a.m. to 8 a.m. on CITR 101.9 FM. Stay tuned.
Now, when you were starting out as a writer, you were Black, impoverished, homosexual. You must have said to yourself, gee, how disadvantaged can I get? Oh, no, I thought I hit the jackpot.
Oh, great.
It was so outrageous, you could not go any further, you know. You had to find a way to use it.
Curated by Barbara Chirinos in partnership with VIF Van City Theater, the annual Black History Month film series shines a spotlight on African North American film and history. This year's program encompasses music, political protest, spiritual, emotional, enterprise, and endeavor. The centerpiece of Black History Month at Van City Theater is the exclusive Vancouver premiere of the Academy Award-nominated documentary I Am Not Your Negro, screening from February 24th. Other highlights include Julie Dash's seminal Daughters of the Dust, the music films Molly Blues and Sign of the Times, and a new Canadian documentary about the untold history of Black hockey players, Soul on Ice.
This music, reggae music, is tell the whole world, you know, telepathically and physically and mentally and spiritually, we are telling them to this music, yeah.
So you heard it here at Rocker Show 101.9 FM CITR, featuring yours truly, George Beard, keeping the reggae music alive on the west coast of Canada. It's all about roots rock, lovers rock, dancehall reggae music. On CITR Rocker Show, Sunday noon to 3 p.m. each and every Sunday. Love of Jai. For over 25 years of doing it nice, warm, and easy. Until next time, such time, keep the faith and spread it gently. Jah bless and Jah guide and Jah out. Bless out.
Your mind on the rhythm and no wine in a ace. Glad I'm up your inner rubber, don't place. Dance out.
Need more vitamin D? Satisfy your craving with the February Discorder magazine. Discorder turns 34 this month, celebrating with the Courtneys, Pale Red, Nothingness, Chapel Sound, Pity City, and three scorching hothead submissions. The issue looks into the fentanyl crisis, with alternative perspectives leading up to Opioid Awareness Day on February 21st. We also find out what's happening to Granville Island when Emily Carr leaves, and this issue features album reviews of Mittens and Chelsea Grimm, live show reviews of Shindig, Quiet City, and more. Thanks to our lovely sponsors, Recruit in Canada, Geist Magazine, Jazz Records, The Rickshaw Theatre, Timber Concerts, The Rio Theatre, The Wise Hall, The Astoria, Steam Whistle Brewery, and Redgate Art Society.
Time to eat the donuts.
You're back with Off the Beaten Path. I'm your host, Issa Arian, here on 101.9 CITR, Vancouver's community radio station. If you'd like to call in, number 604-822-CITR, that's 604-822-2487. What you were just listening to is Lift Every Voice and Sing. It is the Black National Anthem. I feel like we should start a petition to just change that to the National Anthem, because I mean, while I do enjoy the Star-Spangled Banner, something about lift every voice and sing that just makes you, you know, just makes you feel real, real good inside. So as we kicked off Black History Month yesterday, February 1st, 28 days of Black History, even though we live Black History 365 here. We just like to open it up with Beyonce, because there's not really too many other fun things that we're going to get into. So Beyonce making an announcement on February 1st that she's having twins was huge for Black History. I don't know if you found it huge, but I did. I know that I received text messages not only from my group chat, who you would think would talk about Beyonce's pregnancy, but I received it from many group chats who you would not think talked about Beyonce's pregnancy. And I'll let you figure out, maybe in your head mentally, why I didn't think that they would talk about it, but they brought it up. And so, yeah, if you haven't heard, Beyonce has released information that she is going to be having twins, and Coachella tickets sold out immediately, I guess because people want to see pregnant Beyonce spend around $3,000-$4,000 to do it. I don't understand. I don't know why. You know, I don't think that Coachella is my thing, nor do I think I like music videos, but I mean music shows, and it just seems that it's just a little too much. 3 days. Back to what we're talking about here, Beyonce. So last year, February, Super Bowl, she came out with the Formation video, and she performed at the Super Bowl, which people were virulently talking about how anti-American Beyonce is, about how she brought back these images of Black Panthers, and how this was absolutely terrible for the state that America is going on. And what we've seen is the exact opposite a year from now. I'm not saying that the Super Bowl, but we've seen that it's been Beyonce's, I guess, paid homage to Black Panthers in her Formation, just really by wearing a beret and a leather jacket. You know, I mean, that's pretty much all that she talked about. I mean, and even if you read the Black Panthers Manifesto, the 10 points, none of it is really about violence. None of it is really about, it's just about Black freedom. People don't really understand, you know, why people are so always so upset about Beyonce. But what we see now is that white supremacist groups are, you know, really, really becoming open and speaking across, speaking everywhere. I guess yesterday at University of California, Berkeley, there was some protests after that Breitbart writer Milo came. And it seems, it just all seems to be a little backwards when you read the news. But Beyonce, congratulations. Thanks for kicking off Black History Month with a real bang. And I really wish she would have waited till Super Bowl Sunday so she could take some of the excitement over from that, and people can be mad once again that Beyonce did something un-American, like have a baby. Donald Trump also kicked off Black History Month with a small speech. I'm just going to play it because I thought it was, I mean, it was awful. But I'll let you guys listen to it.
Last month we celebrated the life of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., whose incredible example is unique in American history. You read all about Dr. Martin Luther King a week ago when somebody said, I took the statue out of my office. And it turned out that was fake news. Fake news. The statue is cherished. It's one of the favorite things in the, and we have some good ones. We have Lincoln, and we have Jefferson, and we have Dr. Martin Luther King, and we have other, but they said the
The statue, the bust of Dr. Martin Luther King was taken out of the office, and it was never even touched. So I think it was a disgrace, but that's the way the press is. Very unfortunate. I am very proud now that we have a museum in the National Mall where people can learn about Reverend King, so many other things. Frederick Douglass is an example of somebody who's done an amazing job and is being recognized more and more, I notice. Harriet Tubman, Rosa Parks, and millions more black Americans who made America what it is today. Big impact. I'm proud to honor this heritage, and we'll be honoring it more and more. The folks at the table, in almost all cases, have been great friends and supporters. And Daryl, I met Daryl when he was defending me on television. And the people that were on the other side of the argument didn't have a chance, right?
That's right.
And Paris has done an amazing job in a very hostile CNN community. He's all by himself, and he'll have seven people. And
so, Donald Trump took his Black History moment to really talk about how the media portrays Donald Trump in a bad light. You know, he didn't actually, you know, call any black leaders because he said Ben Carson. He said he met with African American leaders. I think it's crazy that people talk about African Americans like we are like a nation yet, and we have like an elected leader, and that elected leader would be Ben Carson. Considering that, I don't know very many who, and we all respect him as a doctor. Like, there was a joke around that Ben Carson didn't have to run for president. All he had to do was do nothing, and he would have been revered in Black History Month forever as the brain surgeon. The black brain surgeon. Yeah, you know that guy, Ben Carson. You know, he would have been in all of those colorful books that I had read when I was younger. It would have, he could have been his own black history, you know, semi-deity. But he decided to run for president and open his mouth and talk about how the time he got robbed at Popeyes and said, "I'm not the guy you want. Get the guy behind the register." And ever since then, people have been questioning Ben Carson's, you know what the next word is, but we'll see. Donald Trump, though, talked about some of the things that Frederick Douglass has done. And I like to highlight a little bit about Frederick Douglass. He's going to be the first of, I guess I'll get three shows in four Black History Month, so I'm going to talk about three different individuals over the next 3 weeks. And since Donald Trump brought up Frederick Douglass, I'd like to talk a little bit about Frederick Douglass. Now, if you don't know who Frederick Douglass is, he was born into slavery in 1818. He's from Maryland, like me, whoop, whoop. And he was born into slavery. He was taught to read at 12. He escaped slavery. He actually had to try to escape slavery twice. He sent back for his then wife and proceeded to live his life as an abolitionist against slavery and against basically for the freedoms for not only black people, but for women. He fought for women. He fought for blacks. He fought for the indigenous population. And if you'd like to read his autobiography, it's the narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass, an American slave. Frederick Douglass gave us a lot more than just you know, I don't even think that Donald Trump knows who Frederick Douglass is. I don't think he could tell you one fact about Frederick Douglass. Watching that was, you know, I was trying to be a little, you know, you want to be a little understanding about, you know, maybe he does, maybe he knows, maybe he doesn't know. But when you take a Black History Month kickoff speech and you only talk to Ray Lewis, you talk to Jim Brown, you talk to Ben Carson, and then you talk about this pastor in Cleveland who allegedly brought you all of these black votes to help you win the state. But when you look at Cuyahoga County, Summit County, the county with Columbus, Ohio is in, and in even Hamilton County in Cincinnati, where that's the county that has Cincinnati. Those are the counties that voted blue. So I'm in the counties that have the most African Americans in them in Ohio. So I'm really confused about where are these African Americans that this guy brought you out, and what makes him a leader to African Americans. So one of my friends sent me a message yesterday about how Donald Trump talked about a little bit about Frederick Douglass is being recognized more and more. He says, today he made a comment about Douglass being recognized more and more. Do you have any idea what he's specifically referring to? He said, well, I think there was contributions. I think he wants to highlight the contributions that he has made. And I think through a lot of actions and statements that he is going to make, I think that the contributions of Frederick Douglass will become more and more. So these dudes think Frederick Douglass is still alive. What a crazy world we're living in, where Frederick Douglass, one of the most prominent abolitionists of slave and post-slavery era, you have a Black History Month day and you don't even talk about somebody that you know. You know, he could have, everybody knows Martin Luther King, and Martin Luther King would probably is definitely shaking his head. I wish he could see through that bust and you could actually hear maybe some of the words that he would say. But we don't have some of the words that Martin Luther King would say, but we do have some quotes here from Frederick Douglass. And Frederick Douglass has taught us that if there's no struggle, there's no progress. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. And one of my favorite ones is, easier to build strong children than to repair broken men. So when we're talking about, in the time, we're going to get into a little bit last weekend about the ban on Muslims coming back into the country. And you're talking about Frederick Douglass and some of the things that he is going to speak on in the future. What really needs to be focused is on, this is an individual who believed in the equality of all people, Black, female, Native American, immigrant. He even talks about these racial and ideological divides in his work. He says, I would unite with anybody to do right and nobody to do wrong. So the real question is that when we see some of these policies that are coming up, the same policies that Donald Trump ran on, the same policies that lots of our government officials said that they were vehemently against. They were against everything this guy stood for. They were against everything that, Steve Bannon, his appointee, stood for. And yet you see these House Republicans falling in line. I mean, while you see some people have had the courage and bravery to actually leave the Republican Party and leave the, they still probably a little bit in the conservative right, but just to leave the party. But then you see some of these prominent figures like Paul Ryan, who just falling in line, it shows how much cowardice we have in our politics. And it's unfortunate, because what we know about Black History Month and Black history in general and Black radical tradition is that it is a constant struggle against these power systems that must happen for us to gain equality for all people. So I think that we're going to constantly see it's just only going to get bigger and bigger, the battles between this conservative, really, really right radical movement and the fight for equality. So what we see with the Muslim ban is that you see how it's actually affecting real families, how it's affecting real people. And it goes beyond politics. It goes beyond what you believe is right, Republican, or you're Democrat, or you're independent, or you're communist or socialist, or, you know, you believe in one of these other systems. Everybody understands that you're banning people families from reconnecting, or people who are in school in you know, here in the States, or people, you're just really disrupting lives. And it's unfortunate because we see that it's not only in Canada, I mean, not only in America what we've seen, but we've seen it in Canada with the mass shooting that happened just a few days ago in Quebec at a mosque where six individuals were killed while they were praying. And similar to the shooting in Charleston, the I don't even want to speak his name, but he came into the mosque a few days prior to speak to some of the individuals there, you know, maybe casing the mosque, you know, trying to see, I don't know, whatever mass shooters do. And then he came back a few days later and killed six people and wounded another eight. And then when you hear that Donald Trump is actually going to take, what they're going to do is they're going to take white supremacist terrorist groups off of the focus of the domestic terror and focus only on a radical, quote unquote, radical Muslim extremist. You know, they don't see white terrorism as an issue. And I can't think of the last terrorist attack. Like when I hear about a Quebec shooting of a white white supremacist going into a Muslim and mosque and shooting it up, and then you hear about about Dylann Roof, who went into the church in South Carolina and shot it up. How come nobody is talking about the radical whites or the radicalization of whites in this idea that it's getting violent? And not only has it getting violent, but it's been violent for centuries here in North America. When when you talk about the indigenous populations here in British Columbia and all over North America, it's pretty constant that terrorism done by white people here in North America isn't terrorism. For some reason, it doesn't fall underneath the definition. So talking about banning people from these specific countries, or people who have who believe in Islam, just the idea of banning people from that's terror. It's not only is it terror to the individual who can't come back to the country, but it's terror to it's terror to our citizens, like black, white, Spanish, Asian citizens, who once you start to you'll get this false narrative in their head that, listen, Muslims are dangerous, Muslims are dangerous, Muslims are dangerous. No matter how many times that you know, we tend to in our minds say that, listen, that's crazy, that's ridiculous, but once we see the president start to talk about how some of these things are false, fake news, and CNN is fake news, and so anything that's not Fox News or Breitbart or some conservative right paper is fake news. And so when people start to believe that, well, maybe he's right, well, maybe we should be banning these people, you know, it's a slippery slope. And what we always know is, well, what I always feel like is that, you know, at any chance, this is going to take a turn for black people. So it's not just that reason that we have to fight these types of ideologies, but it's particularly in Black History Month where the ethos is we are going to fight and we are going to win. And freedom is the goal. It has always been the goal. And freedom means to live free, not to be accepted into this society which picks and chooses at specific points in time who's a terrorist and who's not a terrorist and who's okay and who's not okay. It's, listen, we're not fighting for that. We're not fighting to be accepted into this broken system. We're fighting for freedom, and that's what Black history has been about. So during this month, you know, when you're looking at some of these things that are coming up, particularly between Donald Trump, or not even it's just Trump, it's just, or when you see the things going on in UCal or any universities across the country that are blocking some of these really violently speaking individuals. The guy from Cal said he had two quotes that Hillary Clinton had spoke on during her campaign. Headlines is birth control makes women unattractive and crazy. And would you rather your child have feminism or cancer? Like, what? And people are mad that this guy can't speak at colleges. He's a self-proclaimed internet troll who just happened to become famous, and he makes his money writing on Breitbart, which is Steve Bannon's old, maybe not even old, you know, he was the editor of Breitbart. And it's just crazy that these things have become normalized, and we must fight so that these things don't become the norm. And I know we just talked about a lot, but it's just crazy when there are prisoners who take over a jail, and what they say is that what the prisoner said is that the reason that they took over this jail and held hostages. Now, I just found out recently this morning that one of the hostages had died, and that is absolutely terrible. But what they said is that Donald Trump and everything he did, all we know, all the things that he is doing now, we know that the institution is going to change for the worse. Another inmate was talking to the paper, which is the Baltimore Sun and the Associated Press, and saying that the prisoners want education, effective rehabilitation for all prisoners, and information about how the money is allocated in prisons. Now, when you start to think of prisoners as people, you start to think, well, that makes sense. Well, listen, we want our prisoners to be educated because we want when they come out, we want them not to immediately go back to crime. You know, we as a public and the prisoners want to know how the money is being allocated, because what we know from the privatization of prisons is that this is becoming increasingly less transparent, and the conditions are getting worse. And effective rehabilitation is the same thing as education. Like, what we want, we want to eliminate prisons. We don't want prisons. So prison is a place where you can hide society's ills. Like, when people steal because they're poor, you just send them away. So you're not actually eliminating the problem of poor people. What you're doing is just sending the poor people away. When prisoners start to riot against the president, and colleges are also rioting against the president, instead of blaming, you know, bleeding heart, soft liberals, I feel like what the president and fake news, what the president needs to do is really take a hard look about some of the policies that he's doing and why people are so upset.
That was an excerpt from the February 2nd episode of Off the Beat and Path with Issa Arie. Again, if you want to listen in live to Off the Beat and Path, tune in every 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. Thursdays on CITR 101.9 FM. Thank you for joining us for this week's block of Black History Month's programming on CITR. To revisit these excerpts within the episode or find the full episodes they are taken from, visit CITR.ca. Tune in next week again from 1 p.m. to 2 p.m. for another hour of curated Black History Month content. Please stay tuned as regularly scheduled programming commemorates the month.
Are you interested in Indigenous issues?
Are you down with decolonization? Do you have something to say
or have a topic to share?
We have just the thing.
Join UBC's first ever Indigenous Radio Collective.
We're a team of Indigenous and non-Indigenous people.
I'm Niska from my mother.
From the Tahltan Territory.
I'm a settler from Washington State.
I'm from the Qualicum and Musqueam First Nations.
I am Quechua Indigenous from Saraguro, Ecuador.
We broadcast from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded land
of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Whatever you want to talk about, we're into it. Everyone is welcome, no experience necessary.
Unceded Airwaves airs every Tuesday from 11:30 to 1 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM or at CITR.ca.
Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Unceded Airwaves.
We want to hear your story.